cyclase system and protein kinase A comes on, and in the cardiac muscle cells, it's still true that the bifunctional enzyme gets phosphorylated. But instead of the level of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate falling, the level of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate rises in the cardiac muscle cells. That requires some explaining. How does that happen? And here's the explanation. The bifunctional enzyme that cardiac muscle cells make is a little different than the bifunctional enzyme that liver cells make. And the most important difference between these two versions of the bifunctional enzyme is how they respond to phosphorylation. They respond opposite to phosphorylation. So if I'm going to change this picture to be my discussion now of the cardiac muscle cells version of the bifunctional enzyme, all I need to do is change these labels. Phosphorylation of the cardiac muscle cells bifunctional enzyme leads to the PFK2 side being on, and the PFK, the fructose 2,6-bisphosphatase side being off. So, phosphorylation of the cardiac muscle cells bifunctional enzyme turns it into a I'm turning on the PFK2 side, it becomes a creator of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate and the level of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. Yes, she's repeating that. When norepinephrine binds to the adrenergic receptors on cardiac muscle cells, that the cyclotrans alpha mechanism is the adrenal cyclase system involving creation of cyclic AMP as the second messenger. And therefore, protein kinase A comes on, and protein kinase A then phosphorylates bifunctional enzyme. All of that's the same, both the story in liver cells and the story in cardiac muscle cells. Adenylate cyclase system, protein kinase A coming on, phosphorylation of the bifunctional enzyme. But then it changes because the two versions of the bifunctional enzyme respond opposite to phosphorylation. In terms of which side of the bifunctional enzyme becomes the side that's on. So I hope you can connect the dots to speak about how that would influence the level of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate in the cell and how that would the rate of glycolysis. For the cardiac muscle cells, we're not even going to talk about gluconeogenesis. They don't do it. But we are still talking about control of glycolysis. Let's go on now. That finishes learning objective 16. Learning objective 17 has us look at the one remaining control spot in the regulation of glycolysis that we haven't yet discussed. Control spots, remember, are irreversible reactions. This one, and here's the one we haven't talked about yet. The very last step of glycolysis, an irreversible step catalyzed by pyruvate kinase. A step that changes phosphoenol pyruvate plus ATP into pyruvate plus ATP. How is it controlled? Now that I've reminded you of the reaction that pyruvate kinase catalyzes. How is it controlled? That's the topic of learning objective 17. And notice that learning objective 17 specifically says control of pyruvate kinase in liver cells, because the control factors that I need you to know are not true for other kinds of cells other than liver cells. See, it's often the case that different tissues make their own version of an enzyme. Where it's often two different genes coding for two different versions of an enzyme. You compare the versions of an enzyme in two different cell types. And often the differences that seem to be the most important is in how the enzymes are controlled. And it's often, you know, these differences are often in a way that appears beneficial. where the control in one kind of cell needs to be different than the control in another kind of cell. And pyruvate kinase is a great example, or just about any other enzyme of glycolysis would serve as an example here too, where different tissues, different cell types might make a different version of the enzyme. The pyruvate kinase that liver cells make is inhibited three ways that I need you to know. One of them is mentioned here. The liver cell's pyruvate kinase is inhibited by ATP. That's an allosteric effect, allosteric inhibition of the liver's pyruvate kinase by ATP. And I think you can rationalize the direction of that effect. When the cell already has enough ATP, glycolysis can slow down. This ATP-producing step of glycolysis as a whole being an ATP-producing pathway, that can slow down. Sort of logical, a logical example of feedback inhibition. I really don't need you to know what they say right here about pyruvate kinase being activated by the level of fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. That's true, but I don't really find a need for you to know that. What I do find a need for you to know is three ways that the liver's pyruvate kinase is inhibited. One of them is the level of ATP that's mentioned here. You have to look other places in the book to find the next two things I'll mention. The liver's pyruvate kinase is also inhibited by the level of alanine in the cell. Alanine is an amino acid that liver cells receive lots of from muscle cells in the fasting state. Alanine will get mentioned a whole lot when we go on to our next learning objectives, where liver cells are supposed to be in a mode to use the alanine coming from muscle cells for making glucose, for gliogenesis, using an amino acid. Not a boring idea to this. And it'll make sense when we talk about liver cells trying to be in that mode to be glucose producers for alanine to inhibit pyruvate kinase. At the proper time in the next set of learning objectives, I'll remind you of the advantage of turning off this enzyme and the ways to turn this enzyme off when a liver cell is supposed to be in a mode to be a glucose producer instead of a glucose user. So, two ways to turn it off are by having the level of ATP increase or having the level of alanine increase. And both things might be going on at the same time, doubly turning off this enzyme. And a third way to turn this enzyme off that might be going on at the same time as the first two is phosphorylation of the enzyme, catalyzed by protein kinase A. So now you're sensing that I could connect this to glucagon signals. Glucagon telling liver cells in the fasting state, perhaps, to turn off pyruvate kinase by the glucagon signals leading to protein kinase A coming on, and protein kinase A then phosphorylating the liver's pyruvate kinase. That's a third way to turn it off. And you might have all three ways of turning it off as triple redundancy to turn it off at the proper time. You might find them all three going on at the same time. That's it for learning objective 17. If you know those three ways of turning off pyruvate kinase, and that'll be something that comes up that's really important in the next set of learning objectives. We can go on right now to learning objective 18, which doesn't really involve any new information, just sort of collecting some things that you've been told already and realizing that at this point. We have, with previous sets of learning objectives, dealt with the idea of a cell that's not getting enough oxygen in the glycolysis learning objectives. learning objectives, the oxidative phosphorylation learning objectives, was when we first started thinking about what happens when a cell is deprived of oxygen. And we talked about how all the aerobic use of fuel, we have to slow down, and we even described it as step by step as we could, how the aerobic use of fuel would slow down in a cell deprived of oxygen. We're kind of returning to that scenario here in learning objective 18. It says, in exercising muscles that are not getting an adequate supply of oxygen to meet their demands for ATP production aerobically. It's time for you to collect now the ways that pyruvate dehydrogenase would be inhibited. And also, the more recent information about phosphofructokinase being activated. What you might remember from our previous visit to these ideas is that when all the aerobic stuff, like the pyruvate dehydrogenase reaction, slows down, thank goodness glycolysis speeds up. You predicted for me earlier that that would be nice if glycolysis would speed up at this time. And I assured you that our intuition about what should happen is true. It does speed up at this time. And now you've heard how, essentially. It's by the rise in the level of AMP, that glycolysis, or you might say also a decrease in the level of ATP. Those things happen together. The ATP level decreases and the AMP level increases. ATP can be seen a couple of places as an inhibitor of glycolysis, and AMP can be seen as an activator of glycolysis at this step right here, the BMK1 step. So I think you would address the levels of those two things or some ratio of those two things in your answer about why glycolysis would speed up in this cell. You see, in a cell that's not able to, as the learning objective says, meet its demands for ATP production aerobically, the ATP level would come down as it's being used faster than it can be reproduced. ATP level comes down. And we talked last class about how when the ATP level comes down, ATPs are initially turned into ADPs. Those ADPs start to react with each other in a reaction catalyzed by adenylate kinase. We've explained, in other words, why. When the ATP level goes down, the AMP level goes up. That's been explained already. It's time to remember it now, perhaps. And to address the ATP level, the AMP level, or some ratio of those two things as changing in this cell for learning objective 18, and how that would lead to glycolysis speeding up. Let's speak of the AMP level rising, ATP level falling, or some ratio of those two things changing in a direction that would cause glycolysis to speed up. The reason that the pyruvate dehydrogenase mentioned in objective 18 slows down is, well, this is part of why the aerobic business slows down. When the electron transport chain stops accepting electrons, the ratio of NADH to NAD plus changes. We've traced through those spots a few times, so I'm doing it kind of quickly this time. Here it is again. When the electron transport chain, because the cell's running out of oxygen, stops accepting electrons, then the level of NADH goes up. Correspondingly, the level of NAD plus goes down. Or you can speak of some ratio of those two things changing in a direction that leads to inhibition of pyruvate dehydrogenase. So we have to retrace those spots at this time for learning objective 18. Okay, that's it for glycolysis. And even though gluconeogenesis isn't the very next chapter in the book, I really feel that gluconeogenesis should be taught right after glycolysis. Because as you learn glycolysis, you learn most of gluconeogenesis, it turns out. And we can focus on a few irreversible control steps in gluconeogenesis. And with just a rather short list of learning objectives, complete our inspection of that pathway. So this is where you have some time to find your learning objectives for gluconeogenesis. As I change the PowerPoint real quickly. I'm going to start with figure 31.3. Chapter 31 is the main chapter for gluconeogenesis. And this comes from page 560. Objective 1 says define gluconeogenesis. And I'll offer two definitions and then spend some time reconciling. Gluconeogenesis might be called the path from pyruvate to glucose. So where is gluconeogenesis, if I define it that way, in this picture? And I guess it starts right here with pyruvate. And then the path from pyruvate to glucose up at the top of the page would look something like this. How many pyruvates would it take to make a whole glucose? If I had two pyruvates, this step could happen twice, this step could happen twice, these steps could happen twice, and I could get two glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates, and then one of them could become a DHAP. You know about the interconversion of those two things. And when I've got one of each of these from my two pyruvates that I started with, I've got one of each of these, they can be put together in the reaction catalyzed by aldolase to make something 6 carbons big. And then this step would only have to happen once, this step would happen once, and this step would happen once, and then it should have to make a glucose. So that's one definition. The net reaction would serve as a good overall summary, the way Learning Objective 1 asks for an overall summary. Let's look at the net reaction for that path from pyruvate to glucose. You just told me it would take two pyruvates to make one glucose. So let's choose that as the stoichiometry to express here. Two pyruvates to one glucose. But I want to add some more details about the things consumed to allow this path to happen. You need to spend not only a couple of pyruvates, but you also need to spend 4 ATPs and 2 GTPs and 2 NADHs. I think all of those are worth keeping track of the expense for this pathway. Correspondingly, on the product side, you know what you'd end up finding on the product side, you would find 4 ADPs and 2 GDPs and 6 PSOIs from breaking the ATPs and the GTPs. And from the NADHs, those turn into NAD pluses. You can find 2 NAD pluses on the product side. And that would be keeping track of all the important players. There might be some waters and protons that I'm not trying to keep track of. That would be important players. When we get to more of a step-by-step inspection of the pathway, you're going to want to maybe keep referring back to this net reaction that we just proposed and explain it to yourselves. Find where the 4 ATPs are spent, for example. That'll be allowed by the learning objectives coming up later. just trying to get sort of an overview here in learning objective one. The location of gluconeogenesis. Well, you're expecting me to say liver cells, but I've got another kind of cell to mention as well. Cells in the outer parts of kidneys, renal cortex cells, are also capable of gluconeogenesis. As sort of a part of everyday operation, day-to-day business, the outer parts of kidneys make some glucose by gluconeogenesis for cells in the inner parts of kidneys to use as fuel. But this isn't all just for the kidneys' sake, really. In prolonged fasting, the renal cortex, the outer parts of kidneys, become an important source of blood sugar as well. So glucose to the blood, just like liver provides. The purpose, I guess I just sort of said it. The purpose of gluconeogenesis is to maintain blood sugar. That's its main purpose. Let's just list that one thing as the purpose of gluconeogenesis, maintenance of blood sugar. And when would I expect this pathway to be sped up? When is this pathway needed? It sort of is asking. During the fasting state. And also after one kind of meal that we talked about in our discussions of the fed state, we talked about if it was a pure protein meal, glucagon levels would go up, so gluconeogenesis would be stimulated because you use amino acids for the meal making blood sugar. Learning objective two. But before I go on to that, I said I was going to offer two definitions for gluconeogenesis. Learning objective one asks me to define gluconeogenesis, and I've only kind of done that halfway. Here's the other definition for gluconeogenesis. Sometimes you hear it spoken of as the production of brand new glucose from non-carbohydrate precursors. Production of brand new glucose from non-carbohydrate precursors. So going from glycogen to glucose would not qualify as gluconeogenesis by anybody's definition. Because glycogen is a carbohydrate to begin with. And what I just offered as a definition of gluconeogenesis is production of brand new glucose from non-carbohydrate precursors. To realize that you wouldn't be starting with glycogen for this definition. That's a carbohydrate already. And the pathway for breaking down glycogen has its own name, and we'll study it later. But starting with something like an amino acid, or glycerol, or lactate, those are non-carbohydrate precursors. And I guess I'm refining my second definition for gluconeogenesis right now by mentioning the main non-carbohydrate precursors. Amino acids and alanine more than any other amino acid. But alanine is not the only amino acid used for gluconeogenesis. It's just alanine gets some special mention as the one used more than other amino acids. And glycerol and lactate. So let's find this definition of gluconeogenesis in our first figure here. Here's starting with alanine. Here's starting with lactate. Here's a couple of other ways to start with amino acids other than alanine. And to get onto this road, here's starting with glycerol. See that if you start with alanine or lactate, you get on to the road from pyruvate to glucose right at the very beginning. Alanine becomes pyruvate, lactate becomes pyruvate. And so they're on the road from pyruvate to glucose right at the very beginning. Glycerol, however, gets onto the road at a very different place, much further along the way to glucose. So we're going to want to talk about these precursors and their routes onto the main road. The road from pyruvate to glucose. That'll be my attempt to reconcile these definitions of gluconeogenesis, is to show you how the precursors mentioned in the second definition get onto that main road that was mentioned in the first definition. There will be a little bit of new chemistry in that. When we talk about amino acids like alanine getting onto the road to glucose, that involves some brand new chemistry for us to begin to master. It's boy, this is going to be important as we go on and study amino acid metabolism next quarter. And it becomes important already this quarter. Now I'm ready to go on to learning objective number two, about how this pathway from pyruvate to glucose is not the exact reversal of glycolysis, and why that's beneficial, that it be something other than the exact reversal of glycolysis. You see, glycolysis goes from glucose to pyruvate, and gluconeogenesis goes from pyruvate to glucose. So that's as close as you look. They sound like exact opposites, but they're not. You look closer. So let's look closer. Let's go actually to the very first figure of the chapter. This is on page 557. And it's nice in that it shows all of glycolysis again, going from top to bottom over here on the left side, going from glucose to pyruvate. And gluconeogenesis over here on the right side, going from top to bottom, from pyruvate right here to glucose. And the key thing to notice is that each pathway requires some enzymes that the other pathway does not require. That allows you, here's the benefit of it being this way, that allows each pathway to be controlled independently. If each pathway requires some enzymes that the other pathway doesn't require, controlling those enzymes would be a way of controlling the two pathways independently. That's the benefit I see of the two pathways being something other than exact reversals. For them to be what I would call exact reversals of each other would involve they have the exact same enzymes, exact same set of enzymes for both pathways. And that one pathway is the same reactions as the other pathway, which is going in the other direction using the same enzymes. If that was the situation, there wouldn't be the possibility of controlling the two pathways independently. To control the two pathways independently, you need each pathway to require some enzymes that the other pathway doesn't require. And we just finished talking about glycolysis, where we talked about the three control spots. Those are irreversible spots, meaning that the enzymes at those spots are not enzymes for gluconeogenesis. Controlling glucokinase or phosphofructokinase 1 or pyruvate kinase could be done without affecting the rate of gluconeogenesis. But because those steps are irreversible, don't you realize that gluconeogenesis, to get from pyruvate back to glucose again, would need some of its own unique steps involving enzymes that are not enzymes of glycolysis. For example, if gluconeogenesis needs to go from glucose-6-phosphate to glucose right at the very end, but it can't do it by the reverse of this reaction, because this reaction is irreversible. How does it do it? Well, gluconeogenesis has its own enzyme, glucose-6-phosphatase, which catalyzes a hydrolysis reaction. The water goes into this reaction to hydrolytically remove that phosphate from position 6, making the glucose then exportable. That's the idea, where to get around the irreversibility of a step in glycolysis, gluconeogenesis has its own reaction to go the other direction. It gets a little more complicated down here when we have to get around the irreversibility of the pyruvate kinase reaction. In glycolysis, right at the very end, PEP, phosphoenol pyruvate, becomes pyruvate by an irreversible reaction catalyzed by pyruvate kinase. And gluconeogenesis wants to get from pyruvate back to PEP again, but it cannot do that by the reverse of this reaction. This reaction is irreversible. And notice that it's kind of a lot required, actually, to get around the irreversibility of this reaction and to get from pyruvate back to PEP again. The pyruvate has to change into that, which maybe changes into something else, which then goes back to being oxaloacetate again before it finally becomes PEP. All that required to get around the irreversibility of the last step of glycolysis.
For the
oxaloacetate,
once it goes on itself into something else,
is that just the mitochondria? Yes. A lot more will be said about that later. Her question was, right here where they suggest the oxaloacetate changing into something else temporarily, only to become oxaloacetate again, is that because the oxaloacetate needs to get out of the mitochondrial matrix? And yes, a lot more will be said about that later. It needs to disguise itself as somebody else who's allowed on the matrix. But then, out of the cytosol, it can become oxaloacetate again. There are learning objectives coming up for us to examine that. Maybe I've done enough now for learning objective 2. You know what I mean when I say this is not just the reverse of glycolysis and why that's advantageous? We'll go on. Yes. Do I want you to know exact means of these enzymes? The enzymes at the control spots, I feel very safe saying yes. Those will be ones that will be mentioned by name explicitly in the learning objectives. And maybe that's your best clue that I would want you to know that an enzyme's exact name is if its name appears explicitly in the learning objectives. That's what I expect you to know. For gluconeogenesis or any other pathway, I'm trying to generalize my answer to your question about how would you know when I want you to know an enzyme's name? You'll know because it will be mentioned explicitly in the learning objectives. And I can guarantee you that at key control spots like that one and that one and that one and that one, I guess I just found 4 key control spots in gluconeogenesis that we'll need to describe. Yes, I would want you to know the names of those enzymes. Objective number 3. Wants us to start examining how lactate gets onto this road, alanine gets onto this road, glycerol gets onto this road. In other words, going to that definition about gluconeogenesis being production of brand new glucose from non-carbohydrate precursors. Let's one at a time talk about the non-carbohydrate precursors that are most important, and where they came from, and how they get onto the road to glucose. And a figure that will help us greatly there is figure 31.4. That's coming from the top of page 562. And I'll start with the lactate, because that's totally reviewed. How lactate gets onto the road to glucose. In other words, how lactate turns into pyruvate. You guys know the reaction catalyzed by lactate dehydrogenase backwards and forwards because it has come up in previous sets of learning objectives. Be able to draw lactate's structure and pyruvate's structure, that's already been suggested to you. And then you'll never forget the relationship between them, where the lactate is the alcohol form and the pyruvate is the ketone form. And which side of the reaction would NAD plus go on? Will make sense to you if you think of their chemical structures. Here's a very slight typo right here that I feel I must correct. NADH doesn't have a plus charge. NAD plus has a plus charge, but NADH does not. Are you realizing that that's how lactate would get onto the road to glucose, or the main road from pyruvate to glucose, as it turns into pyruvate? Now, it's been mentioned, actually, most recently in class, I described becoming lactate as going down a dead-end street. You can back up again. From where you came. How does glycerol get onto the road to glucose? In the previous picture, we found glycerol getting onto the road to glucose at a much different spot than where the lactate got onto the road. Glycerol becoming... Well, it's not really one of the intermediates of gluconeogenesis until it becomes this, dihydroxyacetone phosphate. How many glycerols would it take to make a whole glucose? Glycerol only has three carbons, so the simple math works here. It would take two glycerols to make a whole glucose. And so it would work something like this if I just started with glycerols. Two glycerols, this reaction happening twice, and this reaction happening twice, giving me two dihydroxyacetone phosphates. But then, by this isomerase catalyzed reaction, one of the dihydroxyacetone phosphates becomes a glyceraldehyde 3 phosphate. And at that point, I would have one each of DHAP and glyceraldehyde 3 from my two glycerols. The aldolase reaction happening just once. You put those two things together and make something six carbons big. This reaction happening once, this reaction happening once, and this reaction happening once would make a whole glucose from two glycerols. Now you're starting to ask yourselves, could you make a glucose from two alanines? Yes. Two alanines could become two pyruvates, and we've already talked about how two pyruvates. Could you make a whole glucose from two lactates? Yes, two lactates can become two pyruvates. And we've talked about how two pyruvates can get to glucose. Could you start with one alanine and one lactate? I can almost hear you thinking. Yes, you could. Yeah. The possibilities that you're starting to imagine would all work. You could start with one of these and one of these and end up with two pyruvates, which could become a glucose. Could you start with a glycerol and an alanine? By golly, yes, you could. The alanine could become that, and the glycerol could become that, and then you'd have one each of these, and you could put them together and glucose. I think you're getting it. Let's look at the road suggested for the glycerol getting the path by which the glycerol gets on the main road to glucose. And I'll go back to figure 31.4. Which shows that down here at the bottom better than anywhere else. I think it's shown right here. That the glycerol in liver cells now, only liver cells can do this. The renal cortex cells that I mentioned earlier today, they can start with things like amino acids, but they can't start with glycerol. Because starting with glycerol requires that the cell have this enzyme, glycerol kinase, and liver cells are quite special in having that enzyme, glycerol kinase. That's why in previous classes I've said glycerol always goes to the liver, and only the liver knows how to make good use of glycerol. The reason is only the liver has glycerol kinase. And that's the enzyme needed to make use of glycerol. See, glycerol kinase catalyzes the transfer of a phosphate from ATP to glycerol and turns the glycerol into glycerol 3-phosphate. Now that's somebody we've been talking about rather recently, glycerol free phosphate, but this might be the first time I've told you how it can be made from glycerol. Because in earlier discussions, it was coming from glucose. Here's how it can be made from glycerol. She's saying correctly that in the renal cortex, glycerol is not a precursor to gluconeogenesis. The kidney cells do not have glycerol conjugates. They do not have to use glycerol. But I go back to saying that in the fasting state, the kidney cells can become important sources of blood sugar. Gluconeogenesis in kidney cells is something to be aware of. So here's glycerol-free phosphate. You can draw their structures. The learning objective insists that you be able to draw their structures. Many of the structures that you're asked to be able to draw in this set of learning objectives are ones that you've already been asked to draw in previous sets. But I'm warning you, I might ask again, because you need to know those structures still. Knowing those structures now would help you right now. So I repeat the learning objectives and say, for example, be able to draw glycerol, be able to draw glycerol-free phosphate, and be able to draw where we're going next, dihydroxyacetone phosphate. This is a reaction that has been part of our discussions quite recently. It's a reversible reaction that we've seen go both directions now, this time to get from glycerol onto the road to glucose. We need the glycerol-free phosphate dehydrogenase reaction go the direction where glycerol-3-phosphate is oxidized by NAD+, and NAD+ is the oxidizing agent. The glycerol-3-phosphate is oxidized to DHAP, dihydroxyacetone phosphate. And at that point, we're on the road to glucose. This would be, since in the earlier discussions where this enzyme came up, we described both the cytosolic version of this enzyme and the mitochondrial version of this enzyme. Perhaps I should say this is the cytosolic version. The cytosolic version of this enzyme is the version that uses nicotinamide acting and dinucleotide as a cofactor. This is the cytosolic version. Noticing there's two different styles here, and that's kind of unfortunate. It would have been nice if they used the same style in both of these for suggesting a reversible reaction. I kind of like the style they used at the top more than the style they used at the bottom.
It means
the same. They're just talking about a reversible reaction. And I'm saving this one for last because this involves some new chemistry. This is where it gets significantly new information. How does alanine become pyruvate? This would be how it gets on the road to glucose. But how does alanine become pyruvate? Before I explain that, let me not forget to remind you of where these three precursors came from. The lactate comes from red blood cells or any other cells that are working anaerobically. That's where the lactate comes from. Red blood cells and any other cells that are working anaerobically. The alanine comes from muscle cells. That would be by far the main source of it. And the glycerol, let's think about the fasting state, where the glycerol would be coming from in the fasting state. The glycerol is coming from adipose tissue. When in the fasting state, adipose tissue breaks down stored fat, glycerol is one of the things released into the blood. Okay, now back to how alanine becomes pyruvate. They've really only shown you half of that reaction. by showing you the structures of alanine and pyruvate, you can see how they are related to each other. They're both three carbons long. Pyruvate's the one that I've already insisted that you be able to draw. Maybe you usually draw it with the carboxyl group on top. That's the way I usually draw it. But let's be flexible. They drew it with the carboxyl group on the bottom. That shouldn't really bother us. I'm still seeing the pyruvate as an alpha keto acid. I can still find an alpha carbon, alpha relative to the carboxyl carbon. And see that it's a ketone. Pyruvate is a ketone at that alpha position. It's an alpha keto acid. We've already worked on that recognition of it. And now let's look at alanine and how it's related. It's only at that alpha position that they work. At that alpha position, alanine has an amino group. Rather than being a ketone, it has an amino group attached there. And while you're looking at alanine, reinforce for yourselves that it fits what you've established in your minds as what an amino acid should look like. I've insisted that you be able to draw the structure of a generalized amino acid since our first test. And so any amino acid would have this amino group and this acid group attached to the alpha carbon. Any amino acid would have all of this. What makes amino acids different from each other is the other part, that part right there for alanine, what you might call the side chain. For alanine, the side chain is just an alpha. So use that as a way to double check when I, after this, insist that you be able to draw the structure of alanine. Be thinking about its relationship to pyruvate and draw its structure accordingly. And be thinking about it should fit your generalized idea of an amino acid as well. And I think with a couple of ways to double check, you'll really feel confident in drawing the structure of alanine correctly. Like I say, however, alanine becoming pyruvate is only half of this reaction. And you don't understand that reaction very well until you see it in its entirety. So one thing I made available on the portal is this diagram here that I drew and scanned and put into the portal as a separate document, a JPEG document titled Transamination Reactions. When you see an alpha amino acid become an alpha keto acid. When you see an alpha amino acid become its corresponding alpha keto acid, or vice versa, because these reactions are reversible. That's a transamination reaction. So realize this category of reactions exists. That would be a transamination reaction, where on one side you have the alpha amino form, and on the other side you have the corresponding alpha keto form. And that's really only half of the reaction. What they don't show you here, but I did show you here, is that when the alanine becomes pyruvate, the other half of the reaction is alpha keto glutarate becomes glutamate. Let's examine the relationship between those two things. Alpha-ketoglutarate maybe is the one we should look at first because I've already asked you to know how to draw its structure when we talked about the TCA cycle. That was one of the intermediates that I asked you to be able to draw, alpha-ketoglutarate. And we were stressing back then that it is an alpha-keto acid. My way of remembering it is it's an alpha-keto acid that's 5 carbons long, and it's an acid at both ends. Sort of what went through my mind when I drew it here. Now, you're starting to realize that alpha keto acids are often related to a corresponding alpha amino form by a transamination reaction. So the question comes up now, what is the alpha amino form? Or the corresponding alpha amino acid comes from
alpha ketoglutarate to this reaction.
If I just change things at the alpha position from looking like alpha keto to looking like alpha amino, that would be the corresponding alpha amino acid, and its name is glutamate. So even though I'm not making you learn all of the amino acids now, I do find it necessary to introduce a few of them one at a time as it becomes necessary. It is now necessary for me to introduce glutamate. I'm thinking that you just learned two amino acids perhaps today, alanine and glutamate. And they're both involved in this transamination reaction. You see, now we're starting to appreciate what happens in a transamination reaction a whole lot better, now that I'm showing you the entire reaction. I'll read it going from left to right, but notice it is reversible, so you might want to practice it backwards and forwards. But right now, I'm just going to go forwards. I'm going to read it from left to right. Where, no matter which direction you go, you're going to see going into the reaction, one reactant, that's an alpha keto acid, and the other reactant, that's an alpha amino acid. So I'm going to say the alanine reacting with the alpha ketoglutarate here is my example. The alanine is an alpha amino acid, and the alpha ketoglutarate is an alpha ketone acid. They have two very different carbon skeletons, so it's kind of easy to keep track of what happens to each carbon skeleton in this reaction. The carbon skeleton of alanine is only three carbons big. The carbon skeleton of alpha-ketoglutarate is five carbons big. So I can keep track of the carbon skeletons pretty easily. And I can always find the alpha position as well in these structures. And so I'm starting to appreciate with the help of these structures that what went in as an alpha amino comes out alpha-keto. And vice versa, but when in alpha keto comes out alpha amino, that's a transamination reaction. It appears as if the nitrogen or the amino group has been transferred from one carbon skeleton to the other. That's how they came up with a term like transamination in this reaction. The transfer of an amino group. Carbon skeleton to the other. But I need you to realize that going in, you've got an alpha keto acid and an alpha amino acid. And coming out, you've got an alpha keto acid and an alpha amino acid. But the carbon skeleton that went in, alpha keto, comes out alpha amino, and vice versa, by this transfer of the nitrogen. This reaction that interconverts alanine and pyruvate is reversible. We'll need to see it over and over and over again as we go on, continuing into next quarter. And I need you to know the enzymes needed that catalyzes this reversible reaction, no matter which direction it goes. It's got more than one name, but I think I'll be happy with just calling it alanine transaminase, or a common way for people to rearrange the word transaminase is to say aminotransferase. Transaminase or aminotransferase, it's kind of like which part of that word do you want to say first. You want to say the trans part first or the amino part first. Transaminase or aminotransferase. Alanine transaminase or alanine aminotransferase would be common names for the enzyme that catalyzes this reaction. This is a common abbreviation for it, ALT, which in my mind stands for alanine transaminase, ALT. But I do see good textbooks use ALT as the abbreviation and then spell out the name alanine aminotransferase. transferase. So be that flexible. Allow them to say amino transferase or transaminase. The transamination reaction that involves alanine is this one, catalyzed by alanine transaminase. And I'm hoping you can put it together that the alanine reacts with alpha ketoglutarate to produce not only pyruvate, but also glutamate. I've been reminded of the time. Let's take a 10-minute break.
Three more days, like 9 hours left. That's the part of the pathway that we deal with first. Figure 31.5. I would start here, pyruvate in the mitochondrial matrix, and say that this step right here in the mitochondrial matrix is the first step for the path from pyruvate to glucose. And if we wanted to make a whole glucose, we'd need two pyruvates, we'd need that stuff to happen twice. And this picture is really only good for getting us to here. And then it's very vague about the rest of the pathway to glucose. This picture really only tries to elucidate the first part of gluconeogenesis. Starting here, I would say, pyruvate in the mitochondrial matrix, and getting to here, phosphoenol pyruvate or PEP. In the cytosol. That's
what we want to get down first. And the first step of that happens in the mitochondrial matrix, and it's catalyzed by an enzyme you already know, pyruvate carboxylase. That's an enzyme that I had to introduce earlier when we were talking about anaphorotic reactions to refill the TCA cycle with intermediates. And here's another place where pyruvate carboxylase is important. Catalyzing the first step of gluconeogenesis, or the pathway from pyruvate to glucose. Pyruvate carboxylase ends up being an enzyme that needs to be on in both the fed state and the fasting state. We're going to see it as a pretty important enzyme in more than one scenario. That's already starting to happen. Now you're seeing it as an important enzyme in gluconeogenesis. And remember everything you can about that reaction, starting off with your generalizations about carboxylases. They catalyze carboxylation reactions where the new carboxyl group comes from carbon dioxide, or you could say bicarbonate ion if you wish. And carboxylation reactions require breaking an ATP this way. It costs an ATP. The product, the carboxylated product, will be one carbon bigger than what you started with. Pyruvate with three carbons is going to oxaloacetate, which is four carbons here. And oxaloacetate is something you need to remember how to draw the structure of, and to maybe see it as pyruvate with a carboxyl group added. We've done all that before. Now you need to see it as the first step of gluconeogenesis, or the path from pyruvate to glucose. And this might be the first time I've asked you to know that that reaction occurs in the mitochondrial matrix, that the location of pyruvate carboxylase is the mitochondrial matrix. You know what B vitamin would be required by this carboxylase as a cofactor, and that would be biotin. The only other thing I need to remind you of for this first step is that pyruvate carboxylase is activated by acetyl-CoA. When the level of acetyl-CoA rises, that enzyme becomes more active. It's allosteric activation by acetyl-CoA. Most of the steps of gluconeogenesis are going to occur out in the cytosol. There's quite a few steps in this part right here that this figure is being vague about. Most of those steps occur in the cytosol. Many of them are reverses of glycolysis reactions. Glycolysis is in the cytosol. The enzymes that both gluconeogenesis and glycolysis share would be enzymes in the cytosol. Most of the steps of gluconeogenesis are in the cytosol. So here's our present dilemma. We just saw how it starts by forming oxaloacetate in the mitochondrial matrix. And if most of the subsequent steps are going to be out in the cytosol, how do we get out to the cytosol? And oxaloacetate cannot go through the inner mitochondrial membrane. This is something I would expect you to know about oxaloacetate after today. Oxaloacetate cannot go through the inner mitochondrial membrane. So for these carbons to appear out in the cytosol and be used for making glucose, the oxaloacetate needs to change into something else that is allowed out of the matrix and into the cytosol. Something that's allowed through the inner mitochondrial membrane, in other words. And I sometimes speak of the oxaloacetate as being able to put on disguises, where it changes into something else that's allowed out of the mitochondrial matrix, and then out in the cytosol, goes back to being oxaloacetate again. That's where I think I start to think of it as a disguise that it just puts on temporarily to change cell compartments, and then it goes, takes off its disguise and goes back to being oxaloacetate again. And there's two possible disguises for it to put on. Some oxalo acetates would put on one disguise, and other oxalo acetates would put on the other disguise at the same time. Both are shown here. The oxalo acetate can change into malate or into aspartate. I think I'll talk about it changing into malate first, because that's the one you're more familiar with. Remember, in the mitochondrial matrix even, you see the reaction that interconverts oxaloacetate and malate go both directions. You've got to be ready to see that reaction go either direction and be very flexible or very well-versed in the relationship between oxaloacetate and malate. So that you would very quickly say, well, the oxaloacetate can be reduced to malate, and then the malate can leave the mitochondrial matrix. And that's something that we spoke about because of some earlier diagrams that we found. The malate leaving the mitochondrial matrix so that the carbons can go out into the cytosol and be used for gluconeogenesis. We first started talking about that near the end of our look at the TCA cycle and how some of the intermediates in the TCA cycle can be used for building projects. That's when we first talked about malate leaving the mitochondrial matrix and going out into the cytosol.
Is there a functional reason why oxaloacetate can't leave, or is it just a side effect?
She's asking, why can't oxaloacetate leave the mitochondrial matrix? And it would be time to remind you of what a formidable barrier the inner mitochondrial membrane can be. Not the outer mitochondrial membrane, but the inner mitochondrial membrane. Where what it takes to get through there is doorways in that membrane that recognize you. And there are no such doorways in that membrane for oxaloacetate.
Is that a coincidence, or is there a reason that you don't want to get
I would say, thank goodness, the oxaloacetate can disguise itself to get out of the mitochondrial matrix, because that would be required if we're going to use these carbons to build glucose. Somebody else had a hand up? Like I was saying, if this didn't work, if the oxaloacetate's carbons can't get out of the mitochondrial matrix by the oxaloacetate changing into something else temporarily, then gluconeogenesis would have a real problem. And you probably have terrible episodes of hypoglycemia between meals because you can't keep your blood sugar up. I think you proposed something that would be a terrible problem. So thank goodness it works. Usually. Let's go back to how it works when it works.
The enzyme here is one you should know the name of. That's malate dehydrogenase.
And we've already encountered in our talks about the malate shuttle or malate aspartate shuttle
that there's both a mitochondrial version of malate dehydrogenase and a cytosolic version of malate dehydrogenase.
That's just perfect. That allows the malate to turn back into oxaloacetate when the malate gets out into the cytosol.
Here's the cytosolic version of malate dehydrogenase oxidizing the malate back to oxaloacetate. So now we've got oxaloacetate in the cytosol.
We're getting closer. Being able to use these carbons to build glucose.
Once the oxaloacetate appears in the cytosol, then this would be the next step of gluconeogenesis, turning oxaloacetate into phosphoenolpyruvate.
All of this has been required just to get around the irreversibility of the last step of glycolysis.
In other words, just to get from pyruvate to PEP has required all of this, because the reaction catalyzed by pyruvate kinase is irreversible. Now we need to talk about this reaction, the one that changes oxaloacetate into phosphoenol pyruvate. I hope you know the number of carbons that those things have. The oxaloacetate and four carbons. I haven't even made you draw that one. The phosphoenol pyruvate, I'm hoping you appreciate, has three carbons, even though I haven't made you draw that one. I'm hoping that you know it has three carbons. And so there is the loss of a carbon. There is a decarboxylation aspect to this reaction. And so carbon dioxide is how that carbon is lost. It's a decarboxylation aspect to the reaction. Another aspect of the reaction is the transfer of a phosphate from GTP. Gives phosphoenol pyruvate its phosphate. Oxaloacetate doesn't have a phosphate, but phosphoenol pyruvate does. Where did the phosphate come from? It came from the GTP. The GTP converted to GDP by giving up a phosphate. So I see a kinase aspect to this reaction as well, the transfer of a phosphate from a donor to an acceptor. That's about as good as I can do at explaining the name of the enzyme that catalyzes this step. This enzyme is one that, even though it has a terribly long name, I need you to know the name. It's a key control point in gluconeogenesis. The enzyme's name is phosphoenol pyruvate carboxykinase. The best I can do to explain that name is to point out the involvement of phosphoenol pyruvate. It's a product of the reaction. And the decarboxylation aspect of the reaction is where the carboxy part of the name came from. And the transfer of a phosphate is where the kinase part of the name came from. Phosphoenol pyruvate carboxy kinase. People often abbreviate that enzyme by an acronym. They often abbreviate the enzyme's name this way. PEPCK is kind of fun to pronounce. PEPCK. But you're not allowed to call it that until you know what it stands for. What they're trying to tell you right here in this diagram with the upwards pointing arrow and a circle around it is what you can tell from the key right here, that this enzyme, PEPCK, is an inducible enzyme. Like I said, it's a control point, and the main control to realize there is that the amount of the enzyme is controllable. It's an inducible enzyme that liver cells would make more of when liver cells are being stimulated to speed up gluconeogenesis. In fact, I referred to that enzyme quite a long time ago this quarter. It seems like a long time ago. When, in our inspection of the fasting state, we talked about glucagon signals. And I was saying part of how it is that glucagon signals lead to a speeding up of gluconeogenesis in liver cells. You'll remember it when I remind you of how I said it. I said that the glucagon signals lead to phosphorylation of a transcription factor that we abbreviated CREB, CREB, and that then bound to DNA and stimulated transcription of an enzyme for gluconeogenesis. I was describing to you this enzyme, PEPCK, an inducible enzyme. Inducible by glucagon signals in a way that we've talked about. Back then, when I first talked about it, I did not want to use the enzyme's name. Calling the enzyme phosphoenol pyruvate carboxykinase back then would have been a terrible diversion from my main point. I just called it an enzyme for gluconeogenesis.
And I hope that now that I'm getting back to that enzyme and pointing to the fact that it's an inducible enzyme, I might be reminded of that story that we've already told about glucagon signals and how liver cells would be stimulated to make more of this enzyme in the fasting state.
I do need you to know the reaction that PepsiCo catalyzes.
Apologize for the name being so long. I need you to know it anyway.
So we've just traced one route from pyruvate in the mitochondrial matrix to phosphoenol pyruvate, or PEP, out in the cytosol. The other route shown here is for the oxaloacetate to put on a different disguise. It still starts with the mitochondrial reaction catalyzed by pyruvate carboxylase, but then for the oxaloacetate to get out of the mitochondrial matrix, there is this possibility. It can turn into aspartate. And aspartate is allowed through the inner mitochondrial membrane. There's a doorway for it. And so aspartate can get out into the cytosol and out in the cytosol by a reversal of the reaction from whence it came. The aspartate can go back to being oxaloacetate.
Well, this involves transamination reactions. Aspartate is an amino acid. Aspartate is the alpha amino acid that corresponds to oxaloacetate. Oxaloacetate is an alpha ketone acid. It's time to notice that about oxaloacetate's structure, if you haven't noticed it already. Let me put back up this handy-dandy handout for transamination reactions. And have you noticed that there's one more of them that you need to know before you've really mastered all the transamination reactions that you need to master. I hope that's somewhat encouraging. There's only one more that you need to know, and it follows the pattern of transamination reactions. This would be the way that oxaloacetate can disguise itself as aspartate, and then the disguise can be taken back off again. It's a reversible reaction. Catalyzed by an enzyme named aspartate transaminase. Or you know how people might play with that ending to the name, they might say aminotransferase. AST as an abbreviation for the enzyme. Where, I guess I want to first read it from right to left. My representation of it here would be read first from right to left so that I can describe, oh, this arrow right here, I can describe the oxaloacetate disguising itself as aspartate. So let's read it from right to left. The oxaloacetate starts off as an alpha-ketoacid, and it's trying to, as it puts on this disguise, it's trying to become the corresponding alpha-amino acid, aspartate. When an alpha-ketoacid wants to become an alpha-amino acid, that would be a transamination reaction where the alpha-keto acid needs to react with a nitrogen donor. In other words, it needs to react with some alpha-amino acid. And the alpha-amino acid it would want to react with is glutamate. You see, glutamate and its corresponding alpha-keto acid are involved in all transamination reactions. I would always expect for a transamination reaction to have glutamate on one side of the reaction and correspondingly alpha-ketoglutarate on the other side. And if you've got the idea of a transamination reaction, you'll be able to figure out which side the glutamate goes on and therefore which side the alpha-ketoglutarate goes on. For the oxaloacetate to become aspartate, it must react with glutamate. Going into the reaction, you expect one of the reactants to not have a nitrogen. The alpha keto acid will have a nitrogen going in. But the other reactant must have a nitrogen, must be an alpha amino acid. And by the transfer of the nitrogen or the amino group from one carbon skeleton to the other, a transamination reaction occurs. The two carbon skeletons involved in my depiction of this transamination reaction are different. The carbon skeleton shared by aspartate and oxaloacetate is four carbons long. The carbon skeleton shared by alpha-ketoglutarate and glutamate is five carbons long. So if you look carefully enough, you keep track of what happens to each carbon skeleton in this reaction. They're different lengths. You can keep track of the carbon skeletons because they're different lengths. So I guess now you realize that to be a master of transamination reactions, you need to know three pairs of things that you find involved in the transamination reactions of this handbook. You need to know how pyruvate is related to alanine. That's one pair, where the carbon skeleton is three carbons. And you need to know how oxaloacetate is related to aspartate. That's another pair, where the carbon skeleton is four carbons. And you need to know how glutamate and alpha-ketoglutarate are related. They share the same carbon skeleton. The carbon skeleton is five carbons. Once you've got those three pairs of things down, you are a master. You're just close to being a master. Just a little practice, you will be a master of transamination reactions that you need to know for biochemistry.
So I'm looking in the learning objectives and it says three routes by which
The questioner has realized that I haven't finished yet. I've only described thus far two routes by which this oxaloacetate here can become PEP out there. And learning objective 4B says, describe three routes. I've got another route yet to describe, but it's the easiest one. You see, the third route is not even in this picture, and you might consider it to be a shortcut where no disguises are needed. No disguises are needed, making this third route be simpler, really, than the first two routes I described. And that would be where the oxaloacetate in the mitochondrial matrix becomes PEP in the mitochondrial matrix because there's a little bit of this enzyme, PEPCK, in here. There's a little bit of PEPCK enzyme in the matrix. So some oxaloacetates become PEP in the matrix, and then that PEP leaves. And as directly as that, you end up with PEP out here in the cytosol. PEP is allowed through the inner mitochondrial membrane. If PEP does form in the mitochondrial matrix, it would be allowed out into the cytosol, and we could end up with PEP out here as directly as that. That's sort of a shortcut in my mind where no disguises were needed. Now, which route of the three routes that have been described is the route most taken? It's this one where the oxaloacetate disguises itself as malonate. That's the route most taken. The oxaloacetates disguising themselves as cells as malonates, which fits nicely how we first started talking about this in an earlier diagram from the chapter on the TCA cycle, which showed malate leaving the TCA cycle and going out into the cytosol for gluconeogenesis. This is a reconnection. This gets us through learning objective 4B. And Thursday's test will stop with this. So this is where I would draw the line for Thursday's test. There are still two more tutorials. 2 hours tonight and 2 hours Wednesday night. So there's still four hours more of tutorial. You can also try and ask any of your questions by email if you can't come to tutorials. And since I've done this to you, putting this much of today's lecture on Thursday's test, it's not like I didn't warn you. In fact, I kind of scared you into thinking maybe all of gluconeogenesis would be on the test, and I'm not quite doing that to you, am I? But because I did put so much of today's lecture on Thursday's test, and you have an anatomy quiz coming up, I understand, I'm going to quit here today. I'll leave you a few minutes anyway.
Thank you. Thank you.
it's the first.
Right here, you can see.